The story of King David's tryst with Bathsheba begins with these ominous words from 2 Samuel chapter 11. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go forth to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, but David remained at Jerusalem. You're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Just as David remained in Jerusalem when kings go forth to battle, the great Roman general Mark Antony remained in Egypt, captivated by Queen Cleopatra. Let Rome in Tiber melt and the wide arch of the ranged empire fall. Here is my place, he tells Cleopatra. As a result, as Shakespeare explains in the play's title, is the tragedy of Antony and Cleopatra. At the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought this past June, Wyoming Catholic College professor Dr. Adam Cooper introduced Shakespeare's play before we broke up into seminar groups for more discussion. Here's what Dr. Cooper had to say.
I saved the best for last in this this speech, so the beauty will be taking the stage towards the end, so don't fall asleep. The young Octavian quickly became one of three, then one of two, finally sole disposer of the temporal world. Today's tragedy tracks the completion of his rise. He announces at its end the universal peace that he has now at last secured. His Apollonian image, beautiful, dispassionate, like the marble in which he recast the city of Rome, seems to absorb and eclipse those of his predecessors, allies, and rivals. Disposing with the persons and institutions by which he rose, he came to seem at last a self-caused event, even the culmination of history. His famous res gestae divi Augusti, erected on two prominent columns in Rome, Anatolia, Ankara, and elsewhere in the empire, proclaim the acts by which I placed the whole world under the sovereignty of the Roman people, the benefits he secured for his people, the honors he was awarded, or more splendidly demurred. The subject of every major verb on this remarkable inscription is I. Not only are the names of Brutus and Cassius passed over in silence, but also those of Lepidus, Cicero, Agrippa, and Antony, men whose aid was indispensable to his ascendance. The great Julius Caesar, his uncle and benefactor, is reclaimed as my father. With the splendid hubris of one who has so dominated history that history is his to write, he makes himself as if the beginning and perfection of all things. At the age of 19, he begins, on my own initiative and at my own expense, I raised an army by means of which I restored liberty to the Republic, which had been oppressed by the tyranny of a faction. Named heir by his uncle Julius, Octavian indeed began his career at 19, with little but the magical name of Caesar to recommend his untried youth. The authority of Cicero, the warrant for whose murder he later signed without hesitation, opened his path to public affairs. With Antony, he put down Brutus and Cassius, naming himself the agent of divine vengeance, though Antony did the lion's share of the fighting. I struck, says Antony, the lean and wrinkled Cassius. 'Twas I that the mad Brutus ended. He alone dealt on lieutenantry, and no practice had in the brave squares of war. Yet now, no matter. With Lepidus and Antony, Octavian divided the rule of the world until he found it convenient to depose and discard Lepidus and finally challenge Antony as well. He rose to autocracy by calculated steps, careful image crafting, and the cold capacity to use and then discard relationships. If the aura of Caesar's name was indispensable to his success, Octavian had learned the lesson of his uncle's bounty and clemency. Where Julius honored and welcomed in his former enemies, to be in Octavian's favor was always to be in fear. He might praise his noble opposites to enhance his own image, but only after they were fully neutralized or dead. When finally the world was his, he restored in image and in name the institutions of the Republic, for which a grateful and timid Senate, forever after under his thumb and those of his successors, named him the August, a title unknown before, but meant to blend the qualities of man and God, first citizen and monarch. And thus Octavian seemed to achieve the ambition of Caesar, subduing the city that had subdued the world, while simultaneously seeming to achieve the opposite goal of Brutus and Cicero in restoring the public. And while his uncle Julius had only become a god at his death, Octavian, still living, dubbed himself the divine Augustus. Having disposed with every actual or potential rival, Tacitus writes, and he conciliated the army by gifts, the populace by cheapened grain, the world by the amenities of peace, and step by step he rose and united in his person the functions of the Senate, the laws, and the magistracy. All power emanated from him. Indeed, Octavian's far-sightedness, however beneficial for his subjects' peaceful and commodious existence, however detrimental to the self-rule of Senate and people, seems to us not quite human, if not quite divine. More strategist than warrior or even soldier, he played the long game, took no unnecessary risks, let slip no opportunity for advancement, trusted no one, had no friends or equals, enjoyed nothing, cold to the lusts that move other men, and he always won. It was Augustus' reconstruction of the Roman order, reconstruction of the world, that provided the institutional framework for 500 years of world governance and something approaching world peace. Yet, given the heroic figures he superseded, Aeneas, Julius, Cicero, Brutus, Pompey, Cato, Antony, Cleopatra, given the fierce Republican rivalry of unforgettable personalities that subsided and disappeared into his image, Augustus' success might not seem the fulfillment of history so much as a disappointing anticlimax, a reduction of fertile promise, possibility, and variety to a working and acceptable, yet somehow disappointing state of affairs. The Augustan order is one in which adventure, political ambition, and above all, Eros would have no scope, no great stage, no public meaning. The greatest battles and glories were now already won. The greatest prizes either hollowed or out or put beyond the reach of mere mortals. Now the virtues of administration, prudent calculation, wise distribution and maintenance would carry the day rather than high ambition, brilliance, courage, piety, generosity, and pride. The homegrown citizen soldier, once the boast of the people, would be more and more replaced by the mercenary and the professional. The consulate, once the coveted prize of heroic action, would become a ceremonial ornament. The Senate, once the rudder of the state and the stage where the voice of public persuasion might prevail over arms and force, would be demoted to the world's most glamorous debating society. The triumph, the procession up the Via Sacra, once the spur to brilliant generalship, would be reserved to Caesar's successors only. No one else could be God, not even for a day. But behind Augustus, the man who thus gained control of the world, and behind the world he created, looms the troubling shadow of Antony, who threw away this same world for the sweet witchery of an Egyptian kiss. The figure of Antony emanates powerful, subjunctive, and counterfactual energies in the imagination, because the world he might have ruled and shaped in his image, unlike Octavian's, never came to be. Around the canceled couple of Antony and Cleopatra, history's disowned memories, discarded possibilities, and still pregnant desires seem to multiply. In the shadow world of Cleopatra's Egypt, as in Dido's Carthage or Virgil's underworld, we find the lost dimensions and colors, the fantastic opulence, the alluring darkness, pathos, rich corruption, large human virtues and vices canceled in the Augustan world of officialdom. If there is something cold and marble in the image of Octavian, the figure of Antony is blooded and large. If Octavian is the great calculator, Antony's first line in the play asserts, "There's beggary in the love that can be reckoned." He o'erflows the measure. If Octavian is an Apollo uttering and enforcing decrees from afar, Antony is a Bacchus, a Hercules, or a Mars. Exuberant, mighty, impetuous, delighting to be in the thick of a chaos that he himself is causing. Not only his love, but also his soldiership and leadership is a matter of the expansive, spontaneous, and overflowing. His goodly eyes glow o'er the files and musters of the war like plated Mars. His captain's heart in the great scuffles of fights have burst the buckles. His soldiership, says Sextus Pompey, who only sues for peace with Octavian and Lepidus because the mighty Antony stands with them, is twice that of the other two combined. He's a man of warmth and feeling, reaching out and responding to the hearts of other men. Contrast between the liberality, humanity, and personability of Antony's leadership and Octavian's calculated policy runs through the play. When preparing for war against Sextus, Antony remembers the strange courtesies his enemy has recently done him, offering refuge to his mother and his brother when they had when his wife and brother had stood out against Octavian. And he regrets having to make war on him. In their warlike parley, he offers Pompey his hand and liberal thanks for his hospitality. The canny and down-to-earth Enobarbus, Antony's lieutenant, speaks his mind frankly and freely with Antony and everyone else, never dreading annoying his captain, a testament to Antony's tolerance and fraternal spirit. Octavian's Agrippa, on the other hand, at the one moment when he gives advice, recites a carefully conned speech that, as he hints, Octavian has written for him, proposing the politically motivated marriage of Octavia to Antony. The stated purpose of this marriage, to bind the two great men in friendship, conceals Octavian's opposite intent. Yet though a more prudent man could predict that such a marriage will be trouble, especially given Antony's affairs in Egypt, Antony himself does not seem to predict this. He enters seemingly in good faith. Let's be friends. When Octavian seems close to weeping at saying farewell to his sister, while at that moment making her happiness an honor a pawn in his political power game. Agrippa reminds us how Antony, on the other hand, cried almost to roaring to find Julius slain and wept over the corpse of his enemy Brutus. And if we are tempted to believe that there is something genuine in Octavian's more modest tears, Shakespeare soon disabuses us. No sooner has he married his sister to Antony, but Octavian finds ways to slight and traduce his new-made brother in the public eye, goading him to a dishonorable divorce. Octavian breaks the peace treaty that the three triumvirs made together with Sextus Pompey, whom Antony clearly loves. And after he and Lepidus succeed in crushing Pompey, he immediately turns on Lepidus, violating the very alliances and agreements that the marriage is supposed to render sacred. He does all he can to provoke Antony and insult the sweet and virtuous Octavia, knowing how easy it will be then to put Antony in the wrong. When Antony, on the other hand, sees Octavia caught helplessly between brother and husband, he lets her follow her best love, as he puts it, taking her happiness into account. If I lose mine honor, I lose myself. Better I were not yours than yours so branchless. Octavia is grateful for his honesty and the freedom he allows her. When her brother tries to take her unceremonious return as an affront, she says, "To come thus, I was not constrained, but did it on my own free will. My lord, Mark Antony, on hearing that you prepared for war, acquainted my grieved ear with all, whereon I begged pardon for return." Octavius, telling her how Antony has already renewed his affair with Cleopatra in a splendid Asiatic wedding ceremony, ends his account with, "You are abused," and makes her wrongs the justification of his war against Antony. Yet it is impossible not to think that he has not set her up for abuse from the beginning in order that he might avenge. Antony's generosity of spirit creates a rare bond of love and loyalty between him and his men. After his fortunes are ruined and he realizes that he has lost his way forever, he releases them, bidding them fly to Octavius, loading them with gifts of gold, and calling them his friends. But though some depart, the main body continue to follow him, out of undoubted love of their captain, rather than for any auspicious prospects. Long after his star has set, Antony can say, "Our force by land has nobly held. Our severed navy too has nobly knit." And Enobarbus, though he sees that his faith to Antony is mere folly, tells himself, "He that can endure to follow with allegiance a fallen lord does conquer him that did his master conquer and earns his place in the chronicle." The night before a battle that he knows may be his last, Antony shows the open-hearted love that inspires such loyalty, taking his followers and servants by the hand and telling them, "Thou hast been rightly honest, so hast thou, and thou, and thou. You have served me well, and kings have been your fellows. I wish I could be made so many men, and all of you clapped together in an Antony, that I might do you service as so good as you have done to me." If it is his last night in the world, let it be one more gaudy night, feasting and pouring out his heart, reveling in the sweet, sad joys of fellowship. Maybe it is the period of your duty. Haply you shall not see me more, or if a mangled shadow. And when Enobarbus does at last abandon him for Octavius, Antony, learning his desertion, tells his servant, "Send treasure after him. Write him gentle adieus and greetings. Say that I wish he never find more cause to leave a master." A generosity that melts Enobarbus' heart so that he dies of grief, begging his master's forgiveness. Octavian, on the other hand, treats Antony's revolted followers with more policy than kindness. Ever attentive to the theatrical valences, the optics of the situation, he exposes the rank and file soldiers that have left Antony for him so that Antony may seem to spend his fury on himself. Antony's attendant Alexis, hoping to curry favor with his new master, persuades King Herod to shift his alliance to Octavius, and Octavius hangs him for his pains. Octavius grants Antony's defected lieutenants entertainment but no honorable trust, as Enobarbus recognizes. On the other hand, when despite all these betrayals, defections, and disadvantages, Antony's bravery and the loyalty of his remaining men prevail in the field for a day, Antony tells them, "I thank you all, for doughty-handed are you, and have fought not as you served the cause, but as it had been each man's like mine." Antony wants Julius's bold and dashing and prodigal lieutenant seems to inherit one half of Caesar's virtues, his magnificence, generosity, daring, and spark. He inspires love and loyalty as Julius Caesar did. He labors, fights, feasts, and sleeps among his men, showers them with gifts, treats them like brothers, lets them speak freely, and loves even those who betray him. He is the first in their every desperate charge, the last in every desperate retreat, except one. If he is sometimes quick to anger, he is quick to pardon, rich in affection. His men identify with him. He is not only one of them, but somehow all of them together, containing multitudes, as Whitman says. But he lacks Julius' gifts for the long game, for turning every moment to ultimate advantage. He moves men and wins hearts, but he cannot control them. Antony is no Caesar, for Caesar was not only the magnanimous leader, he was also, like Octavian, a far-sighted, ruthless strategist who simultaneously bullied the Senate, wooed the people, and astounded the world by his campaigns in Gaul, out-pompying Pompey, with brilliant success. These strategic qualities reflected in the cold Octavian come head-to-head with and prevail over Julius's warmer, larger, more impetuous side in Antony, as if the two halves of Caesar's name were waging war with each other. Julius had risen again to do battle with Caesar. Yet in the last gestures of his life, Julius Caesar was more like an Antony than an Octavian, too grand to be cautious in the end, preferring to trust his former and potential enemies and walk unarmed among his people rather than cease to enjoy life, free intercourse, and loving companionship in royal unconcern. He would never have agreed to wear the mask. I rather tell you, Antony, what is to be feared than what I fear, for always I am Caesar. Octavian, on the other hand, only protected his interests and consolidated his winnings so effectively because his single-minded focus on surviving, dominating, and governing left no room for considerations of living and enjoying. "The valiant never taste of death but once," says Caesar. But Augustus only managed to live so long because, cultivating a self-preserving suspicion, he ruthlessly preempted and prevented 1,000 imagined deaths. When he died at 75, he seemed to hint that the man behind his perfectly produced mask had never really lived. His last words, according to Suetonius, were, "Acta est fabula, claudita." The play is done, so clap. Cleopatra, reviving Antony for one last kiss at his death, on the other hand, says, "Die where thou hast lived, that the fullness of his life might be consummated in the fullness of his death." The profligate Antony stands as a sign of contradiction to the unquiet peace of Augustus's diminished world. His whole tragedy turns on the gesture with which he threw away this world for an intuition of bliss and fullness, that though he could never quite encompass or secure it, though at moments he curses and doubts it, nevertheless manages to make Augustus's self-proclamations ring hollow. But really, to see and hear Shakespeare's Antony is not easy. Cleopatra says that to imagine an Antony were nature's peace against fancy. In other words, there is something about the figure of Antony that we have to draw on all our resources to imagine truly, but at the same time, imagination could never have dreamed up on its own. We are tasked with imagining him, first of all, because he exists. In other words, history forces something on us here that poetry could not have dared to fancy on its own. Yet only poetry, not history, can reach its meaning. Somewhere here, I think, must lie the attraction of this subject for Shakespeare. History presented the poet with the kind of enigma whose meaning only tragedy could explore and reveal. In this case, reality is the activity of the most august imagination, as Wallace Stevens might say. What Shakespeare's imagination does is to recover history's meaning in the sort of rich and lavish poetry that can only be won by a tragic plunge into history's darker side of broken hopes and unrealized loves. Such poetry plunges us into the subjunctive depths of history, reaching in imagination for the abysmal and transformative meanings that history points to, but always skirts. As T.S. Eliot writes, "We had the experience, but we missed the meaning. And approach to the meaning restores the experience in another form." We had the experience, but we missed the meaning. Indeed, as I was reading Plutarch's life in preparation for this program, I was baffled almost to unbelief by Antony's behavior at the sea battle of Actium. I had hoped the historian would render this scene more plausible to me. He does not. Recall what actually happens. The whole world stands in the balance. The loyalty of Antony's forces is legendary. They want nothing more than to make him king. All the kings of the East are behind him. His superiority on land is beyond doubt. The old commander, in a characteristic show of reckless confidence, accepts Octavian's challenge to have it out at sea, where the odds are in the young man's favor. To better his rival at sea would send an unforgettable message to his men, to Octavian's followers, and to the world. The mantle of Julius Caesar, Antony's own reputation as a general and a soldier, the whole of worldly glory and power all hang in the balance. Bettering reasonable expectation, the battle is evenly poised. Victory is in Antony's grasp. Exciting stuff. But so far, plausible. Then, in the twinkling of an eye, the wind shifts and the view alters. Antony looks to the left and sees the sails of Cleopatra's fleet bound eastward, fleeing battle. That which before seemed large now suddenly seems small. The hubbub of war grows quiet, and without a thought for his abandoned followers, without counting the cost, without considering his name, without deliberating at all, he is off after her, and all is lost. Really? Is this tragedy or farce? Only Shakespeare's poetry and not Plutarch's Chronicle can reveal the motive for Antony's turn at Actium, not only as believable, but as genuinely tragic. In Plutarch, Antony's turn is simply befuddling. Maybe the man is under a literal enchantment. Maybe he is ridiculously depraved, the slave of his appetites. History, with Octavian, will write him down for a shiftless libertine. Well, we should not be slave to our passions. We should not commit adultery. But it needs no ghost come from the grave to tell us this, my lord. The history records the fact, but without the help of poetry, misses and even cancels the meaning. Shakespeare, on the other hand, enables us to see in Antony's self-destruction a ruin that reaches deeper into the heart of things than any actual or imaginable victory. He enables us to see that Antony has something in common with a man who, finding a pearl in a field, goes and sells all he has, even the entire world, to make that pearl his own. What pearl has he found? Shakespeare's poetic and dramatic conjurings of Cleopatra, in her many moods and guises, vital, elusive, excessive, playful, deceptive, capricious, yet deadly earnest, toying with treachery, yet faithful in the end, suddenly violent, yet suddenly letting violence melt in gracious courtesy, shamelessly wanton, yet always queenly and proud, dauntless, fierce, yet also helpless, desperate. Only Shakespeare's poetry, not Plutarch, can help us here. Listen to the poetry. We must behold and see, as Philo says at the opening of the play. To Cleopatra, Antony says, "Fie, wrangling queen, whom everything becomes, to chide, to laugh, to weep, whose every passion strives to make itself in thee fair and admired." And Enobarbus says, "I saw her once hop 40 paces through the public street, and having lost her breath, she spoke and panted, as she did make defect perfection, and breathless pour breath forth." When Milton wanted to evoke the beauties of Eve, without whom paradise would not be paradise, he made Adam speak of her in a language of paradox that echoes that of Antony and Enobarbus. God and nature seem to Adam to have been a little too liberal in endowing Eve with outward beauties, while her reason seems to him wayward, unaccountable, digressive, inexact, even defective. Nevertheless, in her, defects seem perfections. He says, "When I approach her loveliness, so absolute she seems, and in herself complete, so well to know her own, that what she wills to do or say seems wisest, virtuousest, discreetest, best. All higher knowledge in her presence falls degraded. Wisdom in discourse with her loses discountenanced. Authority and reason on her weight, as one intended first, not after made occasionally." By using Antony's bewildered praise of Cleopatra as a model for Adam's praise of Eve, Milton is telling us that Antony here speaks for something as old and deep as the first unfallen experiences of humanity. Antony shares Adam's original intuition of God's first intention of the bliss and bounty of paradise. Eve, in her naked majesty, freely and lightly bearing the gifts with which she is endowed, is a queenly figure whom, like Cleopatra, everything becomes. Her moods, follies, whims, excesses, even for a moment, her sin, and finally her heartfelt sorrow. So enchanting is her beauty that for a moment it distracts even Satan from his goals. Her every air and gesture so overawes the determined strategist that, taken by rapine sweet, the evil one abstracted stood from his own evil and for the time remained stupidly good. Rather than lose the delights of her companionship, Adam, without deliberation, embraces death and divine displeasure. If death consort with thee, death is to me as life, and to lose thee were to lose myself. Thus, the woman in whom the bounteous excesses, accidental splendors, and wandering richness of a nature at rest and at play in God are expressly visible and personally present, and this transports mind and heart out of themselves into a world of blessing or of curse, life or death, but a world that is doubtlessly larger than calculation, larger than the self. In the bewildering graces of Cleopatra, now Venus, Isis, Thetis, now wanton gypsy, jealous lover, cunning temptress, fickle admiral, wrathful queen, proud and noble prisoner, now no more but e'en a woman, and commanded by such poor passion as the maid that milks and does the meanest chores. In the graces of Cleopatra there lives a pristine and potent memory of Eden, of nature's first bountiful intention. Age cannot wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety. Other women cloy the appetites they feed, but she makes hungry where she most satisfies, for vilest things become themselves in her. That holy priests bless her when she is riggish. Antony has known the wonder, delight, and bemusement of beauty. He has known the bliss of a mutual love that is not depleted in giving, but only grows in bounty, depth, and variety, exceeding all limits because it draws on the sources of created nature. Indeed, if one would find the bourne, the limit of such a rare and mutual love, he says, then must thou seek new heaven and new earth. At the opening of the play, he expresses his intuition as a tragic, heroic boast. Let Rome and Tiber melt, and the wide arch of the ranged empire fall. Kingdoms are clay. The nobleness of life is to do thus, when such a mutual pair and twain can do it. Though at moments he tries to renounce this intuition, or doubts its truth, in the course of the play, he acts out and suffers it to the end. Antony and Cleopatra live and die, tragically asserting the fullness of the self-giving and outpouring heart, the excessive joys and pains of beauty, fellowship, and mutual love, over against the universal peace dictated by Octavian, a peace whose terms seems to rule out such grand transporting passions in advance. Perhaps the human condition is such that such passions and joys must often be renounced for those common goods and peace that the earth can countenance. Adam and Eve must say farewell to paradise in order to enter history. Aeneas must leave Troy, forsake Dido. But Aeneas is deepened and purified by the memory of his lover, a memory in which he knows that no civilization, however good, can fulfill the whole fresh promise that nature, even wounded, carries within itself. Dido's shade appears at the center of the Aeneid as the chastening conscience of the Roman project. It is the Aeneas weeps for her death at the very center of the poem in the underworld. And it is this memory of Dido in the Roman psyche that Virgil hopes will somehow enable the Roman to see how those whom he defeats and those whom he aids in his world mission may nevertheless be in many ways brighter, more beautiful, better than he. It will be the ground of his clemency, his generosity, zeal, and his sympathy for the defeated that enables Aeneas to be not only the father of his people, but of the alien peoples. It is his charge not only to conquer or liberate, but also to adopt and uplift. A world order such as Rome's will always be in danger, not only of renouncing Cleopatra, Dido, the large and bountiful Eros of heroes and lovers, the allurements of Egypt and Eden, as joys and splendors too great to countenance on earth, but even of damning their memory to a fatal oblivion. Is there room in the world order Octavian inaugurates for memoria, for the Virgilian tears for things, tears for Dido, for Cleopatra, for Troy, for lost paradise? Has not the Roman world order, the West, the liberal world order, the Pax Americana, etc., often been in danger of attempting to reconstruct history according to the logic of an idea so far-sighted that the memory of dismantled things, the sight of something new, even the present particular, are canceled, edited out in advance? The great humanities, the old truths of the heart, love and courage, pity and pride and self-sacrifice, without which any story is ephemeral and doomed, as Faulkner put it, are always in danger of being discarded as expensive irrelevancies. Look what is happening at universities all over the country as we speak. In the face of such an ever-present danger, there is something purifying, cathartic, even exalting, to be found in Antony's tragic heroism, so decidedly on the wrong side of history, as a recent president might have put it. I think we can even revel in it, in this tragic gesture that throws over the whole world for a single tear, a single kiss that issues from a generous and genuine heart, as Cleopatra surely does, when seeing how she has become Antony's ruin, she simply asks his forgiveness, pardon, pardon, so that he, rising from his dejected meditation on the world he has forgone, replies, fall not a tear, I say. One of them rates all that is won and lost. Give me a kiss. Even this repays me. When Cleopatra first appears to Antony, coming down to him on the river Cydnus, she seems an embodied dream, in which her own pageantry and the elements of nature conspire to sum up all delight, all opulence, every indefinable charm, every alluring promise of bliss. The barge she sat in, like a burnished throne, burned on the water. The poop was beaten gold, purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke and made the water which they beat to follow faster, as amorous of their strokes. For her own person, it beggared all description. She did lie in her pavilion, or picturing Venus, where we see the fancy outwork nature. From the barge, a strange, invisible perfume hits the sense of the adjacent wharfs. The city cast her people out upon her, and Antony, enthroned in the marketplace, did sit alone, whistling to the air. which but for vacancy had gone to gaze on Cleopatra too and made a gap in nature. The winds are lovesick, the waters amorous, the floating throne burns on the water like fire. The woman herself is like Venus, riding the waves at the salt, fresh birth of beauty, issuing whole and splendid from the primal waters. Nature rejoices to discover itself in such a pageant, so fully realized that it outworks nature, teaching nature and the senses to yearn beyond themselves. It is an actual vision, but one in which the spells of music, composition, suggestion, and all their strange, invisible perfumes make the actual blend into the imaginary. When Antony sends for her, she replied, it would be better he became her guest, which she entreated. Our courteous Antony, whom ne'er the word of no woman heard speak, goes to the feast and pays his heart for what his eyes see eat only. Just as the senses, unsure of what they want, are bewildered and enchanted by her strange perfumes, the woman, so wise to know her own, fashions and continually refashions the terms on which she gives herself. Baffled by her no, encouraged by her entreaty, enchanted by her beauty, for her mere image, Antony pays his heart. So throughout the play, Cleopatra keeps Antony, and perhaps herself, guessing, and unable until the end to know just where her heart really lies, even as she seems unable to know whether Antony's truly lies with her. Sending her girl, she says, I did not send you. If you find him sad, say I am dancing. If in mirth, report that I am sudden sick. When Antony, struck by a Roman thought, leaves to challenge Sextus, there is one word more she wants to say to him, but it escapes her. Courteous sir, one word. Sir, you and I must part, but that's not it. Sir, you and I have loved, but that's not it. That you know well. Something it is I would, but oh, my oblivion is a very Antony, and I am all forgotten. Has she forgotten what she wants to say? Has she contrived the fiction of one word more to make Antony hang on her actual words, which will seem to promise something still left unsaid, withheld, to keep him guessing so that he will return to her? Is she simply trying to delay his departure? Is she reaching with artless longing for a word of love, more assuring and final than any she has yet said herself or heard from him? Ambiguities surround all her words and actions. Just why does she flee at Actium? In sudden fear? As a kind of test of Antony? Or did she goad Antony to fight by sea precisely to create the occasion of her flight, as Plutarch guesses? We never get a conclusive word. Later, is she actually willing to conspire against Antony with Octavian's messenger, as an enraged Octavian Antony supposes? Or is it the messenger she is deceiving when she entertains his propositions and even allows him to kiss her hand? Does her fleet in the play's final battle defect to Octavian because, as Antony first despairingly believes, she has betrayed and sold him to this novice? Is she cunning past all thought, as Antony, trying to wrest free from her spell, asserts early in the play? By the end, we can see that Enobarbus, who has watched the storms and tempests of her tears, is right to rejoin, alack, sir, no. Her passions are made of nothing but the finest parts of pure love. This cannot be cunning in her. Indeed, even her most wild contrivances and feints, like her most calmly regal pageants, flow from an at moments anxious and desperate, but infinitely inventive passion of pure love, a longing to inspire, win, enjoy, prove, and secure her beloved's love indeed. Yet amazingly, she finally convinces Antony of her truth with what might seem to be the queen of all her lies. For when she hears how Antony believes she has betrayed him and in desperate rage only wants to kill first her and then himself, she sends another message. Mardian, go tell him I have slain myself. Say that the last word I spoke was Antony, and word it, prithee, piteously. Hence, Mardian, and tell me how he takes my death. With this falsehood, she gains his heart again, and now forever. For he takes her death as his example and deals himself a mortal blow. But finally, she proves this lie and all her other shows and pageants true when she kills herself indeed, seeking Antony as ever, even in the underworld. Now, Charmian, show me like a queen. Go fetch my best attires. I am again for Sidness to meet Mark Antony. Methinks I hear him call. I see him rouse himself to praise my noble act. I hear him mock the luck of Caesar. Husband, I come. Now to that name, my courage prove my title. In the fictional death that Mardian reports to Antony, Cleopatra dies with her last word half spoken. Then in a tearing groan did break the name of Antony. It was divided between her heart and lips. The inability of her lips to express her heart, even in this fictional death, speaks not in the end for that heart's fickleness, but for its fullness and truth. For in her actual death, too, she dies mid-sentence, as if the final word has again eluded her, were somehow still to be said. And if there is something infinitely ambiguous and indefinable, capricious, wayward, and free in her, this is finally not a cunning past all thought, but the mystery of mortal created beauty, of human freedom, created being itself, that can never quite say what it is for, what it most fundamentally means. The beauty of a being bountifully entrusted to itself and knowing at its heart, like Milton's Eve, the imperative to give itself back fully and freely, yet not knowing how and when it should spend or withhold itself, for whom or for what. Even in her death, when arrayed as a bride, she proves her truth, giving herself totally to her husband now at last, depriving Octavian of his fancied trophy. She seems to attract something other, something from the deepest realms of beings, a consort who is somehow both Antony and not. I know that woman is a dish for the gods, says the rustic who gives her the deadly asp. And even Octavian himself, beholding the strange beauty of her death that breathless pours forth breath, is like Satan on first seeing Eve, moved and forgetting himself, speaking in an unaccustomed mode. She looks like sleep, as she would catch another Antony in her strong toils of grace. Shortly before her death, Cleopatra recounts a visionary dream of another Antony, opening her heart to Dolabella, a lieutenant of Octavian. This gentle soldier is filled with pity and awe by the poise she keeps in her downfall. For her sake, he is even willing to betray his Caesar to the extent of informing the Egyptian queen that Octavian, despite his mask of kindness, intends to lead her in triumph through Rome, where she will meet the jeers of leering and indignant citizens. It is this Dolabella, perhaps, and neither Augustus nor Antony, who is the true heir of Aeneas. It is he who takes up and takes on the difficult balances of Roman duty, nobility, and clemency, even in a diminished Rome. He who will carry the memory of Cleopatra and the cosmic dimensions of her bountiful, quiet sorrow, her proud and graceful beauty, the dimensions her expansive imagination seems to touch. Cleopatra tells Dolabella of the new heaven, new earth that would have been had history decided to balk its own rules and swallowing impossibilities made Antony emperor rather than naming Octavian Caesar. I dreamt there was an emperor, Antony. Oh, such another sleep that I might see but such another man. His face was as the heavens, and therein stuck a sun and moon, which kept their course and lighted the little O, the earth. His legs bestrid the ocean. His reared arm crested the world. His voice was propertied as the tuned spheres, and that to friends. But when he meant to quail and shake the orb, he was as rattling thunder. For his bounty, there was no winter in it. An autumn it was that grew the more by reaping. His delights were dolphin-like. They showed his back above the element they lived in. Think you there was, or might be, such a man as this I dreamt of? Gentle madam, no. You lie. Up to the hearing of the gods. But if there be, or ever was one such, it's past the size of dreaming. Nature wants stuff to vie strange forms with fancy. Yet to imagine an Antony were nature's piece gainst fancy. Even as fancy outworks nature in the moods, beauties, and tricks of Cleopatra, nature has made a piece gainst fancy in this Antony, who with grand implausibility really did throw over the empire of the world to pursue the elusive but unfailing promise of her beauty. And for all her feints, Cleopatra finds a way to fulfill the deepest imperatives of created beauty. When moved by the hero who gives up everything for her sake, she finds heart to give herself in a love so total that her imagination seems to peer into the age to come. Guided by the work of Shakespeare's august imagination, we can believe in the promise of Cleopatra's beauty, the heroism of Antony's tragic choice, and the vitality and depth of their mutual love. Because only such an imagination can account for what the historian reports, but cannot explain. Only Shakespeare's imagination of a corruptive and corrupted but still Edenic beauty, which age cannot wither, wayward, sinful, and sorrowful, yet still pure at the center of its being, a pearl worth more than all the world, can account for what history gives us, can approach its missed meaning, can open the experience of history to restoration in another form. This beauty withholds itself from the conqueror, bestows itself on the soul that ventures all it has for it, but still waits, with one word more unsaid, for the true bridegroom, the true king, floating down the river of time to meet him, sleeping and so alluring a quiet that it might catch another Antony within its toils of grace. Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra takes place as if on the very eve of the incarnation, in the twilight of a history that, like an aging campaigner on whose head the white hairs struggle with the brown, seeks out a noble way to die, something worth living and dying for. No other of his plays brushes so close to the fullness of time, reaching out for the hem of the garment while hemorrhaging blood. Such another man was about to be born, a man whose majesty we only dare imagine because history, the fact of him, has charged and fired our imagination with this work, this duty, this last adventure. He would be a true prince of peace, would call his followers no longer servants but friends, make himself their servant. He would incorporate his own into his very body and pardon those who abandoned him at his hour of need. He would forgive the woman who sinned much because she loved much, bathing his feet in her perfumes, hair, and tears. Indeed, he would renounce all the kingdoms of the world, but willingly pouring out his life, count himself repaid to win a single tear, a single kiss that issues from an earnest heart. The quality of Jesus' love is far other than the passion and blisses of Antony, far other from the cold conquest that made Octavian master of a universal peace. But only the poetic and tragic imagination of a Shakespeare or a Virgil, of Antony and Cleopatra, can successfully give the lie to Augustus's pretended divinity and keep history open to, still dreaming of, still on the lookout for a man of men. Only an imagination that sees something in the human heart that might really be put opposite the sum of things and nevertheless tip and even throw the scales. Only such an imagination would be able to say with the Roman centurion, beholding heaven and nature's peace against fancy at the foot of the cross, truly, this man was the Son of God. That centurion must have had something in common with Aeneas, with Dolabella, with Enobarbus, perhaps even with Antony himself. Without the tragic poetry that delights to be moved by such grand, guilty, doomed figures as Antony and Cleopatra, we are all too likely to succumb one way or another to the cold fancies of Octavian at home in his diminished world. We are too likely to pay for our peaceful and commodious existence by repeating with a timid, small-hearted mob, "We have no king but Caesar." Not fire, not sword could have extorted those words from the proud, full heart of Cleopatra.
The story of Antony and Cleopatra, the story of David and Bathsheba, and the story told by Virgil in the Aeneid of Aeneas and Dido bring together the themes of politics and eros. David's reign knew no peace after his affair with Bathsheba and the murder of her husband Uriah. As a result of their liaison, Mark Antony and Cleopatra both end up dead on the stage. Rome is lost. Egypt is lost. And what of Aeneas and Dido? Next week in our final podcast from the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, Dr. Tiffany Schubert compares their relationship with that of Antony and Cleopatra. Let me encourage you to read the story of Aeneas and Dido in Book 4 of the Aeneid as preparation for hearing her insightful comments. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.